So today's talk, I'm titling for now anyway, Why Aren't We Born Enlightened and Then Stay That Way? So as many of my recent Dharma talks have been, this is comes from a Dharma question that someone submitted. Why aren't we all just born enlightened and avoid suffering? So I think there's different ways to rephrase this question. Like, why are human beings the way they are? Why did they evolve to cause so much suffering for themselves and others? If, as the teachings say, we all have Buddha nature, why isn't that manifest from the beginning? Why does it apparently get obscured so completely? And I think that this is one of those questions that in whatever form occurs to all of us, whether it really rises to our, consciousness or not. Why is practice so hard if supposedly we have everything we need from the beginning? How did I end up so deluded? How did my karma end up so heavy? Why aren't we born enlightened and then stay that way? So first, I feel obliged to point out that in Buddhism, this kind of question is considered one that does not tend to edification. And I mean, I'll explain afterwards. Like, I love questions, and I never want to imply ever that it's a stupid question. But the questions that do not tend to edification being the instruction or improvement of a person morally or intellectually. I'm going to share with you a short little sutra from the Pali Canon called The Shorter Exhortation to Malunkya. And so here it is. I have heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Jetta's grove. Then, as Venerable Malunkyaputta was alone in seclusion, this line of thinking arose in his awareness. These positions that are undisclosed, set aside, discarded by the Blessed One, that is the Buddha. The cosmos is eternal. The cosmos is not eternal. The cosmos is finite. The cosmos is infinite. The soul and the body are the same. The soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a Tathagata, or an enlightened being, exists. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. After death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. After a death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. I do not approve. I don't accept that the Blessed One has not disclosed them to me. I'll go ask the Blessed One about this matter. And he says that basically, if the Buddha does not disclose, doesn't explain these things, then he's going to renounce the training. He's not going to train anymore. So he went to the Buddha and said all of this. And the Buddha responds first by asking, did I ever promise to explain that stuff? And Malunkyaputta says, no. He said, and did you ever say, I'm only going to practice if you explain all that stuff? And Malunkyaputta says, no. So then the Buddha says, well, that being the case, foolish man, who are you claiming grievances or making demands of anyone? Who are you to be? And then he says, it's just as if a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives would provide him with a surgeon. And the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker, what caste they were from. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether he was dark, ruddy brown, or gold-colored, until I know his home village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow which I was wounded with was a longbow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring with which I was wounded was fiber, bamboo threads, sinew, hemp, or bark, until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was wild or cultivated, until I know whether the feathers of the shaft with which I was wounded was those of a vulture, a stork, a hawk, a peacock, or another bird, until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was bound with the sinew of an ox, a buffalo, a langur, or a monkey, he would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was that of a common arrow, a curved arrow, a barbed, calf-toothed, or oleander arrow. The man would die, and all those things would still remain unknown to him. So, this is like, and he says, in the same way, if anybody says, I'm not going to practice until I know the answers to all these questions, they'll die before they are liberated. So in a way, this is saying, you know, let's don't get too distracted by all these questions, either to which we really can't find an answer, or it doesn't really matter to our practice. So that's the essential message, is that it's not necessary to know the answers to these questions in order to practice and achieve the rewards of practice. And it doesn't matter, which I think is amazing, it doesn't matter what the answers are. To our practice, it doesn't matter. If tomorrow somehow it were proven there is an almighty God and he's up there and he's looking and he's watching and he planned all of this and it's all due to him, well, that's interesting. Not what I expected, but it really wouldn't matter to our practice. If we found out that, you know, aliens were in charge of all of this, that would be very fascinating, but it wouldn't matter to our practice. So in general, the why questions in Buddhism are considered, just in terms of practice, a waste of time and energy, figuring that our life isn't very long. We have a lot, we have a lot to work on. Now, why in terms of the current conditions, like, you know, I am feeling angry, and why is that? Like looking for the causes and conditions in this moment, in this being, then that makes sense. But the why in terms of why did it end up this way, we'd say just whatever, this is where we are. But in Zen, we don't cut anything off. And we naturally have curiosity about things. And our mind is part of us. I like to think of cultivating understanding as feeding an essential part of us, converting an essential part of us. In order to practice wholeheartedly, we need buy-in or participation from all the different parts of us, from our body, our heart, our mind. So when the mind is skeptical or confused, resistant, bored, obsessed, then sometimes the medicine we need is working with the mind, is working with our views, working with our understanding. So then reading and study and contemplation, Dharma discussion is useful. An intellectual understanding alone won't do it. And we may or may not arrive at an answer. And as this, you know, the view of Buddhism is, in some senses, it doesn't really matter. But the exploration of the why can still be helpful. For example, even though we may say, all right, here's my karma, the question is, what do I take responsibility for it? What do I do from now? Karma meaning your accumulated, you know, conditioning and tendencies and habits and you know, all the ways that you are that are a result of the past. So your karma, that's, you know, and for the point of view of practice, it's just like, well, no use sitting around assigning blame, trying to figure out why you are the way you are. Just this is it. Let's see what we can do from here. But obviously, at some point, it is helpful to, you know, examine, to explore through therapy or whatever your family of origin or your upbringing and how that might have affected you or hurt you or traumatized you or whatever. That can be helpful. So this exploration of why, I think it's why so many people in the Sangha have been enjoying the book Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. So he's a evolutionary psychologist, and he does a great, very engaging job of presenting some of the theories. It's not like, you know, there's some final proven answer, but some of the theories that psychologists and scientists are working with about why the brain evolved the way it did, and, you know, some of the ways that it works and the delusions it's subject to. And then he talks about why Buddhist practice and meditation and stuff can actually help address some of the side effects of the ways that we've evolved. So we were raised, all of us, with a scientific worldview. It helps to be able to see Buddhism in the context of science and evolution and psychology. It helps us make sense of it, to trust it. It seems less than like a 2,500-year-old mysterious thing that we've just chosen to apply to our life, and more like something rational and compatible with the world as we know it. It can help us to be more open and trusting, enthusiastic and willing. So that is essentially a very long preamble to addressing the question of the day. Why aren't we all just born enlightened and avoid suffering? And, you know, what would be being born enlightened look like? We could argue in some ways that we're more enlightened as a baby than we are later on. But really, to answer this, we have to say, what does a lack of enlightenment look like? And there's many different ways, as I've said, to slice the Dharma tomato. But today I want to slice it as saying a lack of enlightenment manifests as resistance to reality formulated around a sense of being a separate and enduring self. Or more simply, resistance to reality based on a sense of self. That resistance, when there's something that we want and we don't have it, there's a sense of dissatisfaction and resistance. If there's something that we don't want and we want it to go away, we have this sense of dissatisfaction, the sense that things aren't quite the way they should be. And all of this basically has to do with us, with me, and how am I doing, and how is my experience, and looking after me and my loved ones and all my. So in Buddhism, we see our first reactions to the world as being attraction, aversion, or indifference. Very basic, like self-related judgments. Oh, that seems good for me. Oh, that doesn't seem good for me, or it doesn't matter. So I'm imagining, I have no proof, but I'm imagining our sense of self starts to form as soon as we're born and we experience cold or discomfort or hunger and our needs are not immediately met. It's like some little cogs in our brain start to go, okay, wait a second. Like somehow I am not in control of that. Like I want this and it's not happening. Like there's some sense of like self versus the world. At a very, I'm sure, very, very basic level. But over time, of course, and we recognize that whatever, you know, brings the milk and the warmth to us is apparently not us, you know, it's some other force operating in the world, and we don't have immediate control over it. And in over time, that sense of self coalesces around the one who wants, the one who demands, the one who experiences dissatisfaction and satisfaction. And then our sense of self gets just more and more and more complex over time. Once we can express ourselves, once we develop a sense of ourselves in relationship to other people, once we identify our more or less enduring preferences, strengths, weaknesses, physical characteristics, personality, you know, it's just so fascinating to watch, you know, watch all of this develop in a child, you know, to watch like, ooh, I can like assert myself and grab that toy from that other kid, you know, like, so there's that self-negotiating in the world. And then at the stage when kids are like, the most important thing, I don't like that kind of, I like that. I like hot dogs. I don't like this. You know, it's like learning to define the self by preferences. And then of course, once we develop skills, knowledge, opinions, this becomes integrated into our sense of ourselves. Once we have possessions, status, responsibilities, all of these things become, as the Buddha described it, I, me, or mine. So describe the process of I, me, and my making. So we just keep on adding stuff to, it's either I or it's me, something's done to me, or it's my relationships, my stuff, whatever. So we feel great concern about the well-being of all that is I, me, or mine. And then, given our amazing ability to conceive of time and causation, and the persistence of people or objects or situations beyond our immediate sphere of perception, we can make this infinitely more complex. We can anticipate, we can imagine other scenarios. Our longing and resistance, our resistance to reality can get, you know, even stronger and more complicated. We can cause ourselves suffering by recalling a memory of something that happened in the past, imagining how it could have gone differently, and how the current situation might be better if we had acted differently. And then we can feel miserable about our current situation, comparing it to that other hypothetical situation. this is a recipe for crazy making and dukkha. So according to the teachings, an enlightened person does not engage in I making and my making. So this is the Upasena Sutta. Once Venerable Shariputra and Venerable Upasena were staying near Rajagaha in the cool forest at Snake's Hood Grotto. Then it so happened that a snake fell on Venerable Upasena's body and bit him. Then Venerable Upasena said to the monks, "Quick, friends, lift this body of mine onto a couch and carry it outside before it is scattered like a fistful of chaff." When this was said, Venerable Shariputra said to Venerable Upasena, "But we don't see any alteration in your body or change in your faculties." Then Venerable Upasena said, "Quick, friends, lift this body of mine onto a couch and carry it outside before it is scattered like a fistful of chaff." So I think what Shariputra was saying, he seemed to be fine. He's just been bitten by a deadly venomous snake, and he seems fine. So Upasena is explaining, Friend Sariputra, in anyone who had the thought, I am the eye, or the eye is mine. I am the ear, or the ear is mine. I am the nose, or the nose is mine. I am the tongue, or the tongue is mine. I am the body, or the body is mine. I am the intellect, or the intellect in mine is mine. In him there would be an alteration in his body or a change in his faculties. But as for me, the thought does not occur to me. I am the eye, or the eye is mine. I am the tongue, I am the intellect is mine. So what alteration should there be in my body? What change should there be in my faculties? Now, Venerable Upasena's eye-making, my-making, and obsession with conceit had already been well rooted out for a long time, which is why the thought did not occur to him that I am the I is mine, etc. Then the monks lifted Venerable Upasena's body on a couch and carried it outside, and Venerable Upasena's body was scattered right there like a fistful of chaff. So why do we engage in this I, me, and my making? Why did humans evolve to engage in this elaborate self-centered narrative? Why do so many of us spend more time in what can be called a self-centered dream than actually being aware of what's going on around us? So this is where I think Robert Wright really helped me to get my mind around this in a satisfying way. And I'm summarizing and paraphrasing. I'm not quoting from him, and he might not agree exactly with how I'm saying this. But my two takeaways from his book was, and I'll start with the first one. One, we evolved a sense of self because it helped our distant ancestors survive and reproduce. We had to individuate. We had to recognize we were a more or less autonomous actor, that our perceptions were not directly the same as another being's perceptions. We needed to speak and advocate for ourselves, to establish an identity and play a role within our community and in our world. That blissful sense of non-separation, which we may have experienced in the womb, we don't really know, right? But chances are more so. That's been rudely undermined from the moment of our birth. And we need not just a sense of ourselves over time in order to look out for ourselves and make plans. We also formed a sense of self-consciousness. So this sense that we have an enduring self-nature over time, and that this I who acts and perceives and decides, and this is the executive I like to call it, this sense of executive I who is in charge. And Wright's book is full of examples from experiments where they've shown that that's generally not true. On occasion it might be true, but much of the time we are acting, even simple things like a movement, that the impulse for that to happen comes from a different part of the brain than where this executive I lives. So we're doing things. I mean, think about this. Think about how you drive. You're not thinking about all the stuff that you need to do in order to drive. It's just happening. But then the executive I, this sense of ourselves, we have to think we're in charge. And Wright makes a good argument for the idea that this sense evolved primarily for the purposes of communication, that we needed to present a coherent story about ourselves, coherent narrative explaining our behavior, particularly to others, but even to ourselves. All right, oh, I did this because of that, and I did this because of that. And so that we seem like rational actors. We seem like rational actors which are in charge of our reactions and choices and decisions. And there's many cases in Wright's book, you know, where there's an experiment, and clearly people are just choosing this thing because it's on the right side of the table instead of the left side of the table. But they come up with really elaborate rationalizations for why they made like a really thoughtful decision about choosing. Well, that clearly, even though like the pantyhose on both sides of the table are actually exactly the same, they'll explain to you why the one on the right is a superior quality. So like all of this sense of I, which is so troubling to us, you know, really just devolved so that we could talk to one another and make up a good story about our lives. And the second takeaway message I take from Wright is, just because something is adaptive in terms of natural selection, it does not mean it leads to happiness or to an accurate perception of reality. Like it or not, natural selection, it's not like it's a thing or an agent, but it didn't care. It didn't care about our happiness. It only cared about our survival and reproduction. It didn't care whether something that evolved in us makes us, gives us an accurate perception of reality or not. Case in point, he talks about the built-in reaction that humans have to anything they perceive as a snake. And just, oof, you know, ah. So we have this big overreaction, and you know, a lot of times it's just a shadow or a stick or a rope or something like that. They said, you know, in natural selection, it pays for us to overreact to anything that could possibly be a snake because, you know, one time in 1,000, maybe it is, and then our life is at stake. So anyway, that was a good example. So where does this leave us in terms of practice? And you might be a little surprised at where I came to with this. So my take home message for the day, there's a long preamble about questions that do not tend to edification, explanation of I making and my making. But my take home message for the day, which applies to this question, but also to any aspect of our practice, is that anything that causes us suffering has its origins in something good. In other words, any tendency or thought or behavior pattern, misperception, whatever, that is problematic arose originally because of something that was necessary or beneficial to us. In the case of our gradual obscuration of our Buddha nature, of our connectedness, of our interdependence, of the vibrant life we can live in the full awareness of the emptiness of self, we need to individuate to establish ourselves. In order to become a being capable of self-understanding, of enlightenment, we need to develop a strong functioning self. Ironically, I guess. And this is also our undoing, but there is no other way. So the Buddha way is about a fully functioning self waking up to its true nature. And this is why we say no sentient beings, no Buddhas. So our practice is about the maturation of beings who have grown and come to imagine themselves as separate, who have accumulated decades of karma and can't imagine themselves as Buddhas, then being able to awaken to how that is so. So there's There's no getting to the ultimate why, of course, but the answer to the question, why aren't we just all born enlightened and avoid suffering, is essentially, then there'd be no Buddhahood. We'd miss the journey, which is the whole point. It's the returning home after the journey, which is the reward. And similarly, anything that causes us suffering or seems to obstruct our freedom and happiness has its origins, if you look far enough back, in something good. Something that originally was meant to help us, to protect us, make us happy. And we may have to trace that chain of causation back quite a ways, right? There could have been quite a string of bad decisions that got added on, but originally. For example, a number of us have been talking recently about the karma of irritability and frustration, the habit of going about our daily lives and bumping up against people or situations that seem designed to oppose us, and then having a reaction, however small. And such karma can seem very persistent, and we even talked about kind of silly and just stupid and counterproductive, but nonetheless, it can undermine our health, our relationships, our enjoyment of life. So why would we have developed such a useless habit? Especially seeing as like this irritability and this frustration usually doesn't like result in anything good, right? It doesn't like make stuff go away. It doesn't make stuff stop opposing us. Usually it's just a, you know. So we can trace this habit, this manifestation back, maybe not in the case for everyone, but I think in many cases, to an energetic determination. Good thing at the root of this irritability is a clarity of purpose, an ability to follow through, energy, the ability to concentrate, to get things done. And this is an immensely valuable thing. So the suffering arises, of course, just when we take things to an extreme or something becomes so habitual that it may not even be the best response in a given situation, but we just fall into that anyway. Or when we add narratives or justifications, we construct reality for the self around our karma. So the second take-home message then is practice is a journey away from peace, or practice is a journey into separateness. And enlightenment is inseparable from that journey. So practice is a journey into separateness and back to wholeness. So if we didn't experience that separateness, we wouldn't appreciate the wholeness. So I'll leave you with a famous Zen quote. Took me a while to find this. I thought it was in Dogen's Mountains and Rivers Sutra, but it isn't. It's a saying by a different Chan master. It says, 30 years ago, before I practiced Chan, I saw that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. However, after having achieved knowledge and having gotten away in, I saw that mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. But now that I have found rest, as before, I see mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. So we have to go through the stages of practice in order for Buddhahood to manifest. I'll leave it there for comments or questions. Anybody in the cloud, you are, it's most helpful if you hit the reactions button at the bottom of the screen and click raise hand, because then you'll pop up to the front of my screen and I can see. And anybody in the Zendo here you know, raise your hand and then you come and sit in this chair to ask your question so the folks in the cloud can see you. Dave.
So I hope this isn't too off topic, but while you were talking, my mind went to something that I learned in recovery. Because something a lot of people struggle with is, why am I doing this to myself? You know, why am I drinking like this? Literal poison that you're pouring into your body. And one thing that is used, has been discovered to be useful is acknowledging the good things that alcohol did for you. This is a family tradition. This is how I got close to my friends in high school. This is that thing. And you have to acknowledge that and then just tell it, you're not doing that for me anymore. You know, but you have to recognize the good thing that that led you here before you can really let go of it.
Yeah. I think that's a perfect example. A perfect example. You know, like this has helped me be less inhibited and feel more social and intimate with people or whatever. So like originally, and then there's all kinds of like personality quirks and reactivity and stuff, which came from, you know, maybe in our family of origin, we were protecting ourselves or we were standing up for ourselves, or, you know, we were deeply hurt. So we learned to be very wary, but then we keep on carrying these things right past their point of usefulness. Oftentimes, or we've just, that's our default mode and we don't know how to be any other way. James.
My question isn't really fully formulated, but I'm going to give it a try. Going back to those questions about that the Buddha said, do not lead to edification, about the nature of the cosmos and the nature of the self and all that. Do you ever get a sense that those types of philosophical questions emanate from some kind of subconscious desire to not ask the really hard question? If I externalize my experience, it reifies my sense of self, and I don't have to really turn inside myself because the answers are out there.
Definitely. And we can, as you talk about that, it makes me think that this manifests much more often in a more subtle way, you know, even in the context of our practice. Maybe somebody knows, you know, they're not supposed to ask about, you know, whether the universe is infinite or something like that. But similarly, we can wonder about emptiness, or we can wonder about no self, and we can kind of project those out as the philosophical, metaphysical things that we can ponder and question, you know, and in a sense that we can spend our whole lives just like, oh, let's see, you know, talking philosophically about the emptiness of self without like turning within and examining, what is this being? You know, what is empty? Because that's scary, right? That's much more daunting to face our own karma, to face our own fears. Good point. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry for the awkwardness of having to come up here.
But. Yeah. So yeah, you talked about like I, me, mine, how it develops over the years, but is it possible that people are born differently and of 4-year-olds or 8-year-olds, if you look at 8 of them, some are different than the others, and some are more generous or some are more like the Buddha nature or whatever you call it, right? So is it possible that some of it is coming from past lives, if we believe in that, or...
You know, I think this is one of those examples where like I'm completely agnostic about past lives myself, because I can't, you know, in true agnostic, I can't prove it isn't so, and I can't prove it is, right? So But, and I also feel like it doesn't matter. Again, this is a question that does not tend to edification. Who cares? But I do really like it as an explanation for why people are so different.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like, I think it's a convenient, it's like a metaphor or a myth that conveys a truth that we're not, we're it looks like people are in different places on their spiritual journey.
Yes.
And it's not all due to what happened this lifetime somehow.
Right.
So go figure. I think it's true. I think it's, but I think the beautiful thing, perhaps the ironic thing, is that you might think then that maybe there's some people who have, for one reason or another, they seem to be a little further along this path, and then they don't have as much work to do, perhaps. But it actually, because of this whole sense of like needing to go into the wilderness, to go into the separateness, to go into the suffering and then realize wholeness, that, you know, sometimes the most deluded people, the most tight and miserable and deluded people, experience the biggest liberation. Go figure. The world is a mysterious place. Thank you for that. Sufi.
Hello. Well, this was a question that I have been thinking about, but now I really like the story of the poisoned arrow. And that's almost like, what is the meaning of life or something like that. There's just no real answer that you can get. And that really helped me. And I don't know, have you talked about the makkyo, the delusion or that can come up during practice? And maybe that's, I could think that sort of a makkyo, that it's just not something that you really need to think about. You just need to sit down and shut up and practice.
Yes, exactly. That's another great example. So makkyo is various kind of far out experiences that people will sometimes have either while meditating or in the rest of their lives, just when they have been practicing meditation. And it's all, you know, in some ways, teachers hesitate to talk about it because it kind of sounds cool in a way. And people are like, oh, maybe I haven't been meditating hard enough because, I don't know, you can see visions or smells or, I don't know, mild hallucinations and whatever. Although, frankly, a lot of times it's actually quite unpleasant. It's like, you know, energetic physical sensations or involuntary movements. Or I had one guy with the smell of dog poop when he meditated. So but it does make, you know, it is an interesting thing, you know, like your brain is working differently. How does this happen? It kind of feels a little bit like you might be onto something because you're kind of shaking things up a little bit and loosening assumptions or whatever. So it can be very intriguing and can become something indeed, just like this, that like people can become very curious about and obsessed with or worried about or whatever. And so similarly, that kind of, well, you know, who knows? Who knows why this happens? And it doesn't really matter. And I think it can be encouraging to hear that if you experience such a thing. And there are physical things you can do during your meditation or at other times to kind of ground the energy in the body and minimize these things. So that's helpful too. But I think it can be helpful when we are very not obsessed, but you know, you're really caught up in pondering something, to hear that it's okay, you don't have to worry about it. It's not is not really that important. You don't have to figure it out. You just kind of just let it be and keep practicing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So you kind of talked about like letting go of your default methods. And sometimes like I think of that in my personal life and I'm like consciously trying to let go of my default methods. But I'm curious, what does it take or what is your personal rationalization or realization of how to let go of your built-in default methods and kind of returning to unconsciously kind of conducting yourself with a conscience or conduct yourself in a manner that's more like what you, how you want to be, like a little bit more calm, a little bit more centered.
That's like the 10,000 or $10 million question, isn't it? Like, if there was only just a simple prescription, an answer for how can we just, I mean, to use Buddhist terminology, be more mindful, right? Be more present in our life so that when we're living, when we're perceiving, when we're acting, we're like it's coming out of a living place rather than just, you know, the automated. It just does not seem to be easy. I think every one of us kind of finds a different way in. You know, there's basic mindfulness practices of trying to be, you know, present in the body or bring your awareness to your hands or to your sensations or saying verses throughout the day to remind you of things or ritualizing things, anything to kind of, you know, ring a little mindfulness bell to bring you back from the self-centered dream. But, you know, interestingly, I just talked about this yesterday at our term student retreat. For me personally, I've always found it incredibly difficult to willfully go about my life and try to be more present. I mean, it's like my mind is doing this, and then if I had to add up the moments that I was like, all right, you know, here I am, and I'm behind the wheel of the car again, right? It would feel like, you know, maybe 10 minutes out of a day, just, it would feel like almost never. Like most of the time I'm just up here in the self-centered dream and then periodically I touch base on Earth. And that can be really frustrating. That can feel like, you know, why can't I be more awake for my life? But I feel like there is this force of karma, there's this force of habit built up over decades that just keeps our minds going in a particular way. And I just recently happened upon, if I just put a very faint half smile on my face, it just shifts everything energetically. And it's not a willful thing. It's not a discipline. It's like a choice. And then just things kind of open up, present for a little while, you know, then the mind goes off again. But I don't know. So I feel like each of us is finding our way. How is this body mind going to be willing to show up? So does that make sense? Even though it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Got time for one more? Leah.
clicking various buttons. Okay. I like the theme of this talk because it's making me feel more gentle with myself about having this ego that is very in charge and driving and I, me, mine, and everything like that. You know, it's sometimes it's disturbing to be in meditation and to notice how much you've been in that I, me, mine zone. And it's in the noticing that's good, that I like to get to. But I like to reframe it all in this feeling of forgiving myself and accepting and saying, here it is, here's the ego. And that's, I'm not fighting it. I'm not trying to say, no, you're supposed to not have, you know, that ego's bad, bad you. More like this acceptance and self-compassion, and just embrace it and bring it forward and say, here's me at my giant ego having some time. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I know I told this story before. Now I totally understand. I've heard my teacher's stories over and over and over and whatever, you know what I mean? Someone only has so many stories. So I was really struggling early on in practice, or early on in practice was actually fine. And then a little bit later, and I became ordained, and then it was just like, oh, this is so hard. I'm not making any progress. And I went to go hear the Dalai Lama speak when he was in Portland. And I don't remember anything except for one statement. And he said, you have to have a really strong sense of self in order to do this practice. And I was like, well, then great. I might actually be able to do this, right? Like, it was incredibly encouraging. And not that I really understood exactly what he meant, but I was like, well, then I'm a prime candidate for this practice. And it can be, you know, occasionally when I sit in Zazen and my mind is just, you know, going 100 miles an hour and just obsessively just going over stupid projects, and it's just, it feels like the karma of that is just unstoppable, that I might for a moment just be able to step like this, but then so looking at it from that point of view, if like, if enlightenment is about somehow getting this under control or taming it or stopping it or even transcending it and then living in some other special zone, that just seems impossible. And when I think about being a Zen teacher, I feel like a complete fraud. I'm like, what? But fortunately, that's not the nature of the practice. I mean, it is in the sense that we have to become really intimate with this self. We have to see in the ways that it is crazy and deluded and not very helpful anymore. You know, in a sense, we have to, just like a addict with drugs or alcohol has to recognize, all right, of course, you know, we're not going to forgo the self, so that the metaphor breaks down there. But we have to recognize this is not, being attached to it, believing in it, being so obsessed with it is not helpful. But it's still there. It's still very much there. So recognizing, I mean, that moment of recognizing the wholeness, the completeness, that nothing is lacking whatsoever, happens in this self. You know, with this self does not obstruct that in any way, which is such a big relief. You know, it's like, oh, okay, it's not actually a problem, Phew, because I sure wasn't ever going to get rid of that. All right. Well, thank you all for coming. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. Mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you
all for coming.
Thank you.